I'm Adam Rappaport, and this is the Bon Appetit Foodcast. All right, this week we have on Amir Khalib Thompson, a.k.a. Questlove, a.k.a. drummer and co-frontman of The Roots, also known as the house band for The Tonight Show. Amir just released, I want to say, his fifth book and his first cookbook called Mixtape Potluck. Quest will be the first to tell you that he's not a chef, not really a cook, but he has lots of friends who are, from professional chefs to other artists, musicians, entertainers. He called upon them to each contribute a recipe to form a sort of edible mixtape. And we also talk about his first book on food called Something to Food About, in which he interviewed prominent chefs such as Daniel Hume, Michael Solomonoff, Dominique Crenn about their creative process and how it syncs up with his and other artists. And we talk about creativity in general on this podcast. We talk about his favorite Philly cheesesteak spots because he's from Philly, and a lot more. All right, here we go. I like the fact that you know your way around a microphone. That's an obvious statement, but...
I'm 49% creative and 51% suit. And the problem is,
it's a good combo.
My fellow creatives know I'm a suit now. So one time Bismarck, he chastised me. He's like, "Hey, yo, Quest, yo, man, when you turn into a suit, man?" And I was just like, "Dog, I've always been a suit. Like, someone has to organize. You know, you can be creative and organize at the same time." So.
That's also, I kind of like, that's the, that 51%, 49%, as far as I understand, is like the Vegas formula. Like, that's how the casinos stay in business. Mm-hmm. It's a pretty slim margin, but when there's that many millions of dollars being exchanged, that slim margin ends up adding up.
And it makes you, it makes me, the sucker, still feel like a winner.
But that's my, we're recording, I guess, but that's my, I kind of look, that's my sort of life mantra, actually, now. It's like, as long as you're doing 51% of your life is fun, 49% is still going to drive you crazy and be annoying, and but you just got to, hey, I'm still coming out ahead a little
bit. See, I'm glad you said 51 fun, because, okay, well, right now I'm at a transformative stage in my life. You know, 50 is like around the corner, and I know, well, I mean, just in general, coming from where I came from, especially as a survivor of 90s hip-hop environment, ask anyone that was actively around anybody associated with Death Row Records or Bad Boys, especially during the 94 to 97 Civil War, that, you know, in my early 20s, the main goal in life was just to not get shot in the club.
Yeah.
The club. Nine times out of 10, hip hoppers, you enter entertainment as a means of survival. So it's hook or crook, you know, do or die. You gotta, you know, I mean, Biggie once rapped that, you know, you either sling a rock or you got a wicked jump shot, or you saying rhymes on the block. That's not necessarily my narrative. So I think there's like a small percentage of people that like actually enter into this art form just as a means of expression. Not saying that, you know, there was a better option. I mean, yeah, I could have went to school and all that stuff, but it's just the idea, Wu-Tang invented the idea of called, quote, eating good, and eating good means successful. So it's almost like a badge of honor to kind of have a pot belly in your...
Yeah, you're prosperous.
And your formative hip hop, it's like, yo, you eating good? Yeah. I see you eating good, which basically means that you're not starving, because, you know, like growing up in poverty, that can definitely be part of your narrative, like not having food to eat and that sort of thing. So, because everything is done excessively, you know, I'm more than certain that Patron wasn't created to be consumed in one fell swoop, like under an hour, like two bottles straight. You know, it's supposed to be
consumed responsibly, as they say.
Yeah, like months at a time, you know, have a shot here, a shot there, but that sort of thing. So, I mean, as a result, it's catching up to a lot of us. And all too often, I mean, the fact that Chuck D, Ice-T, Flavor Flav have successfully gotten to 60 is a miracle.
So you're coming up on 50 in what, about a year?
I'm coming up on 50 in 2021. So, and so as a result, which leads me to what we were talking about with 51-49, there's a book that I discovered called The Gene Keys. And, you know, it's there's a chapter in there where they speak of there's two ways to approach life. You can, most of us approach life through fear, you know. And that was definitely the narrative of my life in the beginning, like from the roots, from childhood, navigating the correct path to walk to school to avoid the bully. Even to my career, like, okay, well, I used to have three shows planned just in case something messed up, like just in case we get heckled, go to this song. Or if the audience is not moving, then I'm going to switch this show around, do the big hit single first and that sort of thing.
So you think, it's interesting because I think there's those people who are really successful who always think they're one step away from losing their job, and they that kind of motivates them and lights a fire under them.
That I was like, that person.
Yeah.
Which is why, I mean, you know, it's cute to be like, yeah, I got 14 jobs. Like I teach college, I have a radio show, I do food thing, I do Fallon, I score movies, I got the Roots, I got a DJ gig. But really, it's because
cookbooks. Don't forget cookbook.
Yeah, I mean, there's, I mean, Hamilton. I can go on, but there's the reason why I've been obsessive. It started with 21, and then once I realized I had to keep a girlfriend, I had to whittle it down. So now it's kissing maybe 12 jobs, and I'm trying to get it to 7. You know what I mean? Like literally saying no to something yeah. is one of the hardest things that I had to learn. So that said, I think it's just that need to have security to know. Because, you know, even getting a record deal right after high school, I thought this would be over by 1999. You know what I mean?
And yeah, if you look at the average career, whether it's a pop star, hip hop star, they've got their 5 years.
Yeah, right.
Of like they have the 1 year where they're huge, and then they kind of milk that for a while. And then
you would have never ever told me that I still might be not even a thing, but just a thought, a speck by the age of 48, 49.
But that's where the suit comes in because you're also thinking as a career. Let me ask you this: so then, coming up, how differently do you eat now? Do you have like of someone who cooks for you? Are you minding?
Yeah.
You had talked in another interview about doing meditation and that sort of giving you a mental clarity.
So
what
you're,
about food?
You're the first time that I'm actually talking in retrospect from what I was last year. So as I said, last year I was, before then I was fear first and nothing. So my new F word is now faith, which it's still a learning curve for me. Like the idea of bungee jumping into a situation that you don't know if you're safe or not. So now I'm trying to make fun, what you said, or faith, the 51% and the other 49% instead of the opposite, which I was really a 70% to 30%. I was probably at my worst. I'll say that I use the excuse of the excessive amount of quote research from Something to Food About, of which, you know, like during the height of doing Something to Food About, especially with Daniel whom like yeah. allowing me into the secret room upstairs, like the test kitchen
at 11 Madison,
yeah, to figure out what you know next year's dish is going to be or whatever experiments they're working yep. on upstairs. I mean, it was just to the point where 11 Madison was like turned into like my Burger King. Like you're only supposed to eat at 11 Madison.
That's a pricey burger joint. Yeah, yeah, like once a year.
Yeah, once a year, yeah. Maybe like three times within a 5 year range. Yeah. But then it's like, I'm starving.
Was this self-realization or did someone have to intervene and say, hey, Amir, we should talk?
You know what? My current girlfriend nuanced it in such a way that it was a sucker punch that it was 7 hours later before I realized, hey, wait a minute, what's she mean by, you know what I mean? Like, she just caught me at a low point. Like, I was doing bad. I'll say around, like, October of last year, I was, like, 410 pounds.
That's crazy. So then, so what'd you do? How did you start that journey?
Well, number one, I got therapist. Yeah. I got a therapist who taught me something about, you know, panic eating. It's weird, like with other vices, like if it's alcohol, if it's drugs, if it's sex, if it's anger, if it's kind of the vices that are like frowned upon in society, then that's like a real thing. But it's yeah. like, how wimpy do you feel when sugar is your thing. You ever see what's DiCaprio's film? You ever see Basketball Diaries?
Yeah.
Okay, so there's like an iconic famous scene of his where he's doing this cold turkey. The scene's like 12 minutes. And, you know, you believe it. Like, his snot is like lime green coming out of his nose. Like, you really believe that he's going cold turkey. And I was like a step away from that. I didn't realize how much, like, if you take sugar out of your, and I mean everything, rice, potatoes, soda, fruit, anything sweet, like, for the first 21 days, I didn't know if I was going to make it or not. And it's to the point I had to have people stay over to stop me from going to Postmates or, you know, any of those things. So.
And then did you break through? Did you get that second wind where all of a sudden you were like, I don't crave it?
I'll say by day 30, then I became like determined. Like it was like building a mile high Jenga.
Yeah.
That.
But you knew you could do it.
You didn't want to break. So defiantly, I was like, you know, there have been moments where like I'm watching them eat spaghetti or, you know, especially at work. I'll say this much. As much as I hated Dr. Oz's presence at 30 Rock across the hall from us, because when we were first on the air, and this leads into how like something the Food About got made, because like every world-class chef comes on the Tonight Show. And in the beginning, you're like, oh my God, I'm eating something that Martha Stewart created. Or, you know, like Dominique Gansel come in.
You gotta get in there.
Right, and you're like, oh, I'm so lucky. And then, you know, just came to the point where like, I mean, between like April Bloomfield and like, you know, Chang sending us like all this cookies and everything, that's how you bloomed up.
Yeah.
Like my greatest experiment, do you remember when KFC invented that double down burger?
Oh yeah, but there was no bun, just two chicken patties.
The chicken was the bread.
Yeah, genius.
So one time I was like, I'm gonna conduct an experiment, and I sent an intern to go get 50 of those, and I tweeted out, I was like, free double down burgers, and you know, in the hallway, and of course it was going in 10 minutes. Everybody was lined up, and you know, and that was literally the most slowest, lethargic, like Tonight Show taping ever.
Yeah. You don't feel good.
Like Higgins was like, and here he is, James. Like that's how it was.
So what do you do now? Because like one thing about New York, and especially in your being in the entertainment industry, so much of your job or one's job in that world is literally being out, being social, going to Momofuku Sambar, and someone's getting the bosom and all that sort of stuff, and you want to be part of the crowd, and you have like a bandmates, manager, all that.
I didn't realize how central food was to everything I do.
With this book, that's how people get together. They get together around food, and food's almost an excuse to get together.
So imagine trying to find an alternative to that, you know. I dropped sugar. I stopped looking. I stopped this whole counting the days like a prisoner. Mm-hmm. When I got past 150, truth be told, I got a there's an app on that counts days for you, so you don't have to do that. Because it was to the point where like, all right, 6 p.m., come on down. 119 days, Mark. You know, that sort of thing. And it was driving me crazy. So I think by like 150-something, I stopped counting. And then, you know, another thing is when the weight started to melt and the compliments come in, I handled it way better than the first time I did. The first time, so this is the second time I went through a weight transformation. And the first time, I did it as a diet and not as a lifestyle or as in terms of therapy. So for me, being that exposed, like not having a protective shield of weight, not being used to people being so nice to me and, you know, oh, wait, I could date this actress now? Like, wait, suddenly I'm cute and I became like super cynical. But now, I mean, I have ways of, well, first of all, alternative foods, there's way more options than there were the first time around I did in the late 90s.
Well, you came out with that Questlove cheesesteak, and there was that ginormous piece in New Yorker last week or so about impossible foods. And this notion, I feel like there's less of a stigma now about plant-based or vegetarian or vegan, that like, oh no, like there's delicious food out there, and eating that way doesn't make you a hippie or whatever.
A weirdo,
you know,
right.
It doesn't make you, right. mean you're hanging out at the health food store from the 1970s.
I was definitely one of those people clowning. Like, my sister was world famous for, like, you know, this type of diet, or what is that, tofu?
Yeah.
Out of here.
Exactly.
Yeah, like the way that, see, the thing is, that, you know, and I don't want people to mistake, impossible burgers are equal in calories as something that's regular.
Well, especially if you put cheese and mayonnaise and bread and everything right. else on there.
Right. You know, I mean, my involvement with Impossible Burgers probably more or less to do with that it's just cleaner for the environment.
Yeah.
A cleaner option. I mean, and definitely, yes, I don't consider it a lesser of evil, but, you know, it's definitely...
Calorically, it's not doing... I mean, that's what the New Yorker profile, which if you haven't read it, Tad Friend wrote it. I recommend anyone out there. But just the notion of can this change the way food production around the world runs?
I think that's important.
Environmentally speaking.
That's important. And the fact that, I mean, what really drew me to it is the fact that, I did a blind test with Shake Shack, of all things, and I kept choosing Impossible Burger. Mm. And it's, you know, not bad. Like, hardcore vegans are still like, you know, Beyond over here. And I know, I understand the logic. Impossible Burgers are made for cats like me.
They want to appeal to the majority of the world, not because if there's, I don't know, there's 5% vegetarians out there worldwide, but they want to appeal to the 95%. And can you whittle that crowd down?
Hardcore vegetarians and vegans all told me that the problem with Impossible Burgers is that it tastes too much like the real thing.
Yeah.
And that's what they're not, their palate's not used to that. So they trust beyond sort of field goal,
yeah,
as opposed to Impossible's Hail Mary touchdown.
So where are you at now? Do you feel like you're in control now? Are you still counting the days? What is your relationship to food now compared to 10 years ago?
I'm in control. One, there's better options. Well, okay. One, I hired a full-time chef because the thing was, left to my own devices, oh God, especially in the age of Postmates.
Oh my God. I am never worse that when I'm home alone and my wife is out, my kid's asleep, I feel like I deserve it, and I order all this Chinese food and I just sit there and I eat the whole thing. If I was out with two other people, I would share it, but if it's by myself, I have no governor. I can't control myself.
I think when you're by yourself, everyone turns into Tom Cruise at the beginning of Risky Business.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like, just sliding across the living room floor.
The week that man, there's a 24-hour Popeyes in Brooklyn. Hmm. Dog.
Did you ever get the fried chicken sandwich? Did you ever sample it when it came out?
I got lucky. I didn't realize that it was a thing that people were like waiting around the block.
It happened. I got off the subway. There's one right around the corner of me on 23rd. And this was, I guess it just started. I got off the subway at like 6 p.m. and there was a line out the door on 8th Avenue. I'm like, what is going on here? And I'm like, oh yeah.
I got lucky. So I'm kind of new to this whole Comic-Con. I'm doing a Disney film. So I didn't know what a D23 was, which is D23 is like Disney's version of Comic-Con. We're like,
you're doing music or voiceover
I thought they were pitching me to score the film.
Do you have a costume?
No, I'm in a Pixar film.
Okay.
And at the end, I was like, okay, so how much music you want? They're like, no, you're in the movie. I was like, rrr. Anyway,
that's a good sound effect.
That said, when they did the character reveal of everyone, like Tina Fey and Jamie Foxx and me and everyone, it just so happens that at Disney there was a Popeyes like down the block, and I saw like a small line. I was like, wait a minute, I heard about this thing. People standing, but the line was so small because it's in Disney.
Yeah.
So I was like, all right, this is probably the quickest I can get one. So I only had to wait 20 minutes for it. I did it. I think it's more of a great marketing spin than anything.
Yeah, I feel like it turned into just like an Instagram opportunity so people could say they went and got it.
Exactly.
Like, you live anywhere now, there's amazing fried chicken sandwiches. You can go to the Commodore in Brooklyn or any place and get a great fried chicken sandwich. I'm like, how much better could it be? And I'm a big Popeyes fan from growing up in D.C. back in the day, but I'm like, I don't know. I'm sure it's fine.
It is what it is.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Your book, Something to Food About, you talked to all these chefs from Daniel Hume, Nathan Myhrvold, and Modernist Cuisine, all sorts of people about that creative process and sort of the notion of being a chef, comparing that to being whether a musician, a comedian, and like the creative process.
Mm-hmm.
You told a great story on Malcolm Gladwell pod about DJing the sort of the going away party
at
the White House. And you kind of wrapped it up with with the president coming to you saying, yeah, well, you know, sometimes you just got to give the people what they want.
Right.
What do you think that balance is if you're like a chef coming to food, like the balance between giving people what they want, but also making them think and challenging them and introducing them to something new?
I think there's an expectation factor when you're dealing with, and I still don't know how to categorize the Ludos of the world or the Homes of the world, or, you know, where you're not going to eat full food to get full, you know, to satisfy your hunger. I think you're there for like an immersive art experience.
Yeah.
Okay. So let's go back to 11 Madison. Like when you go there, I expect bells and whistles, you know, they might play three card Monty with you, they do a magic trick, you color in something, like that's the fun of it to me. So I expect something totally weird from them. Or even with Dave Barron, who used to have Next in Chicago.
Sure, with Grant Atkins.
Yeah. So one time he did an experiment, he called it trash. And I thought they were trolling me because the entire staff like snuck out the kitchen and like was like creeping behind the wall like to see like, like that Mikey Life commercial
Mikey
thing.
Likes it.
Right. They were looking like, here.
Emma here, who's 20, whatever, has no idea what Mikey Likes It is. She's like, no.
Aren't we all?
Yeah. You can Google it on YouTube.
Yeah. It's just, I thought they were, he gave me a plate and it was eggshells.
Literally.
It was trash. It was what you would call compost or whatever.
Yeah.
It was eggshells, a fish bone. An eye. I hope it was a fish.
Yeah. Not a human eye.
An eye, a foot of maybe a chicken foot or something like that. Literally things that you would never ever think
you'd
to eat.
Throw away, yeah.
And he put it in front of me and I thought like, okay, or, you know, where's Ashton? Like that sort of thing. He's like, go ahead, eat it. So it took me like 10 minutes to like figure out how to navigate it from the plate to eating it. And I was like, all right, get a spoon. And what I'll do is I'll put a little bit on my plate and then I'll close my eyes and eat it. And the eyeball was there. And it was the best thing I ever tasted.
What? Why?
Because, I mean, he lives for that. So, wait, his follow-up was dessert. He says, okay, all right, I'm going to get you a banana split. And he comes back and puts a tossed salad in my face. And I was like, huh? I said, is this another trick? He's like, yeah, it's a banana split. Sure enough, the lettuce was like the sweetest tasting vanilla caramel lettuce. The tomatoes were like strawberries.
Yep.
The radishes were like walnut flavored. Like it, I mean, texture wise, you knew it was a salad.
Yeah.
But it was like, it was dessert. And you know, I mean, it's for me, it's like for those guys that infuse science and all that stuff in their food. Like I consider it art more than I consider it food. So
you want an experience, you want to think when you go there somewhat.
Yeah. I mean, you have expectations of it. So I would like to think that I'm somewhere in between a well-experienced wedding DJ and a shaman. Do you understand in terms of
DJ gives the drunk guests exactly what they want.
They give them what they want. And, you know, a shaman...
They're going to play It Takes Two and all that stuff. And
yeah. But with a shaman, if you're into, like, deep meditation, there's a whole presentation with music and noises, and you meditate, and it's supposed to, you know, it does something to you spiritually. And I'd like to think of myself somewhere in between there. Okay, so the first person in Something in Food About, Nathan Miravol.
Yeah.
Who isn't traditionally... a chef?
He's a food explorer of sorts.
Yeah, but I'm to go, have you ever been in modernist cuisine out
I've
there?
Met with or him you've before. Heard about I haven't been out
so
there.
So basically, he's Willy Wonka.
Yeah.
And when he gives you a tour of the whole place, you know, you see robots and things that you're not supposed to Instagram that'll come out 9 years from now and, you know, and his kitchen and all that stuff. But it's like, you know, in my line of work, I often service the everyday blue-collar person.
Yeah.
So I know it's going to be... I know that my celebrity will only allow me a little bit of leeway if I want to figure out how I can make sense of playing a Benny Goodman song, a Roy Orbison song, a James Brown song, a Run DMC song, and Taylor Swift.
Like and keep the party going.
I can keep it going, but it's like I have to turn everything into a CSI episode. So when I'm about to do a quasi high profile wedding in 2 weeks, and this couple, it's kind of
they might be insulted if they listen and find out they're only quasi high profile and not like legit high profile.
Okay, the groom is a celebrity musician, and the bride is a very well respected fashion world person, and they're culturally very different. She comes from a very strict religious background, and he is a rock star. And so both of their families are coming. And so it's going to be a challenge because, you know, I'm thinking of what he is like musically.
Yeah.
Which is kind of the opposite of what I can do with her, you know, like with her family.
But I personally think creatively those parameters are what make the creative process interesting. And it's like, if you're Daniel Hume at 11 Madison or Heston Blumenthal at Fat Duck, like, how do you make food that's really thought-provoking but also delicious enough so that people come back? If you're an art rock band and you only want to sell 10 albums, you can do whatever you want and no one cares. You still have to get that, I'm going to make people satisfied while still sort of challenging their notions.
But I'm noticing there's something I discovered maybe like a year and a half ago that I didn't realize, is that You also can't discount, because the thing is, as a DJ, I can't wait for 1 a.m. Because 1 a.m., I know they at least have 3 to 4 drinks in them. Then, oh my God, 3 to 4 drinks in them? I'm going to play Fozzie Bear and Kermit's Moving Right Along from the Muppet movie. You know, I'll do more of my riskier moves once I know that they're looser and alcohol is consumed. And it's definitely the same with restaurants, because the tasting menu for wine is also a big part of it, and a lot of the riskier experimental foods happen during like course 5, 6, and 7. So
yeah,
you're kind of already open for the ride anyway. So
one thing you mentioned in Something of Food About, at the time that you did that book, you acknowledged in the intro that there was a lack of diversity in whether you want to call it fine dining or contemporary dining. Mm-hmm. It feels like since then you have chefs like Kwame Nwuche in DC and Michelle Mabelli in down in Atlanta and Water Jordan in Seattle, and you have them in your book. Like, how do you think things have evolved in the last 3 years and that sort of national dining scene?
There's definitely a paradigm shift going on across all spectrums, not even in the food world, but in entertainment and, you know, politically, we're still trying to figure that one out.
You still have a 70-whatever-year-old white guy potentially running against another 70-year-old white guy.
Yeah, but it's setting off. I mean, it's setting off a change. It's setting off a change, which is kind of weird because the change that Obama spoke of, like, I think the domino effect is really happening now.
Yeah.
Like, so, and I'm certain that, you know, in retrospect, Trump will probably try to take credit for that, too. Like, you know, even as the bad guy, I caused change in a way that he never could, you know, that sort of thing. I think it's just a matter of time. I know that in the circle and the spaces that I've been in, it's not done in the way that is more red carpety. Yes, let's include you too. Like, I mean, I have a lot of conversations because 9 times out of 10, if I'm invited into a space that I have to give an opinion or create something culturally that previously no one that looks like me has been on, you know, I'm on a lot of boards of things. I usually know it's like, okay. And then I'll tell my manager, like, okay, they're trying to cover their ass, right? And so the six of us just got invited into this thing to...
And now everyone's going to look at you when a certain topic's brought up and like, what do you think?
Right, exactly. Yeah. No, I've been in that situation before. So, you know, it's like, you know, is a field goal as crucial and important as a well-done touchdown? Or, you know, does it still win a game? Yes, it does. You know, more power to him, especially with Kwame's story, because, you know, I've been to his first restaurant.
Oh, the Shaw Bijou?
Yeah.
You're one of the few.
And I know. I got lucky with time. And, you know, when it was no more, I wondered, like, damn, like, is it really? I know that starting restaurants is one of the hard, like, I know.
Well, yeah, I mean, that his story, and he was on the pod, and that just the investors, and then shit starts to go sideways, and all of a sudden, everyone's at each other's throats.
It's
and,
hard to do, right, you know, it's hard to maintain.
And
so
you don't
I'm
get
so,
that money back. You can spend $500,000, $1 million on a restaurant, and if it's out of business in 2 months, and you've done Broadway sort of performances, you know, it's like, nope, shutting it down, that's that.
No, I mean, for a year, I was at Chelsea Market. I was the bell of the ball at Chelsea Markets with the...
With hybrid.
Yeah. So
why'd you get out of that? What happened with that?
You know, to tell you the truth, of all the circles I've been in, and that's comedy circle, music circle, the movie world, I fear the food world the most, because there are plenty of people thriving in this marketplace that, you know, you would see it as the kind of equivalent of buying your way into a fraternity or sorority without having to go through Hayes Week or that sort of thing. And I know people are really big on respect and, you know, and not just like buying your way in. I mean, Sam Jackson used to make this a major issue with rappers suddenly taking roles that should have gone to well-experienced actors, you know. So I didn't want that situation. What I did want was really just a year or two, and this is before we started doing the food salons. We wanted a good year of at least establishing relationships with the gatekeepers and the tastemakers of the food world. And I felt like this was an honorable way to do it. I mean,
to at least show them that you're committed.
Chicken and I are fond of each other.
But, so, but hey, I'm not a dilettante. I'm actually committed to opening a place and
I'm not
giving
just,
it a shot.
Right.
But business wise, did it make sense? Is it worth the headache? Is it like running a food business is slim margins?
I think that for anyone getting into the food business, especially in terms of like, especially in Manhattan, you're going to have to commit. You're going to have to really commit for 7 years, and you know, take some losses and those things. I think to get out,
and you literally had 16 other jobs. Literally,
yeah. I think the plan was always like, let's do a year, let's see what's up, and when it came time to renew it. It's like, well, we got the relationships already. Like, why don't we just skipped to the fourth grade and started doing the food salons, yeah. which is all we wanted to do in the first place.
And the food salons are at your place, in your building, having people over, have a chef cook yeah. some food and just hang out.
The impetus of the new book is basically, well, I mean, this is me having guests come to bring a meal, but my food salons are at my house, and I have like three notable people, so it's like Kwame will come by, or Dominique Ansel will come by.
And then a lot of those guest chefs and guests find their way into this book as contributing recipes. Yeah.
Eric Ripper, yeah. you know, like they'll come by.
Not a bad guy to come by.
Yeah, I mean that, and that's the thing. It's from the nuanced relationship of, and a lot of them were just curious, like, okay, the Roots drummer has a fried chicken right. spot. Let's see what's up with that. And you know, it's like once you get their respect, and then you can nuance relationships. So it was just, we were already ahead. Let's just get out and go to the next level.
You talk a lot about Soul Train as being a sort of a formative show in your childhood, like your Proust Madeleine, if you will. What is your Soul Train of food from growing up? What do you look back on?
Well, it's weird you asked that because I was trying to explain to my assistant. I was trying to explain to her. We just did a show at the Apollo the other day, so we drove by Sylvia's, and I was trying to tell her that at one point this was like the culinary epicenter of every African American, like soul food. But I was explaining to her that, you know, soul food was more like survival food. And now today it's high end cuisine. You know what I mean? And the way that it's surviving is more from a tourist angle. So when you go yeah. to Sylvia's now, it's families from Japan, people from Australia, people from Europe lined out like on Sundays.
Yeah, Sunday morning's crazy.
Totally, yeah. It's the opposite of what its demographic was 50 years ago. And I was explaining to her like, for now, for survival food, 9 times out of 10, it's probably Asian takeout. You know, cousins in the next generation, like to them, instead of like, you know, when I was growing up, survival food was, okay, you got to have grits for breakfast, put sugar and butter in it. Now it's oatmeal. Dinner, you put a pound of government cheese in it. Now it's like, you know, some sort of half polenta, half, you know, souffle thing. Like you would have to make grits it was part of your everyday. And now it's like seen as a high-end food. So now survival food is more Chinese takeout. And so for me, at the beginning, like I remember when $10 was a full soul food meal. But now, you know, average restaurant I eat at, you know, it's definitely in the three figures, which is kind of crazy yeah. to me. It's like,
no,
wow.
It's crazy. But if you were going back to Philly and you're going to have one meal, your mom's going to cook one meal or something, what would that meal be?
And it's not a cheesesteak?
Well, no, it's something that, home cooked.
My mom's, okay. My mom used to make her version of arroz con pollo.
Okay.
She used to call it Roya Capoya. but yeah, hers was the best ever. So that's like her signature meal to me.
All right, we are going to do
Lightning round.
Okay. You get either or questions. You got to answer. Oh, wait, Topgolf? I read that somewhere in a GQ article.
Yeah, I it's not coming to Philly. I would love to bring that to Philadelphia.
How's your swing?
It's better. The girl I was dating at the time, she murdered me in that game, which kind of was
motivates
the downfall.
You.
No, murdered. And then we stopped dating after that. You can't beat me in sports.
All right, ready?
Yes.
Either or. Whiz or provolone?
I'm going to break the rules.
All right.
Whiz.
Okay. Do you have a preferred cheesesteak joint in Philly that you recommend to people who aren't from there?
I have a top five.
Okay. Wow. All right. Let's go.
Number five is George's Cheesesteaks on Girard Avenue. Number four is Ishka Bibbles on South Street. Incidentally, named after Mo at the Three Stooges, because his last name is Ishka Bibble. Fun fact. Number three, I will give to Cosme's in South Philadelphia. I believe that Cosme's would weekly feed the entire Sopranos crew and cast by shipping up hoagies and cheesesteaks there.
That's how they stay so hefty.
Yeah. Number two is Tony Luke's.
Okay.
Sure. And if you're a New Yorker, there's a legit Tony Luke's right across the street from your stadium in Brooklyn.
Barclays
Center. And I'm giving, they're going to kill me for this. I'm going to give my number one cheesesteak to D'Alessandro's.
Okay. Why?
Because it's everything you want in a cheesesteak. It's when the bag is oily by the time you get home.
Yeah,
if you're going to eat it and you might have to go to the hospital afterwards, then that's the right cheesesteak.
<That's right. laughs> All right, next question. Off the wall or thriller?
Off the wall.
All right. Phillies, Flyers, Sixers, or Eagles? You get one to watch the rest of your life.
All right. Let's see, Gritty makes me love the Flyers.
Oh,
I was going to be Gritty for Halloween. Eagles give me hope. Sixers are right there. I feel like this is going to be their year.
They are on the cusp.
Yes. Sixers. I'm going with Sixers.
All right. Drumstick, thigh, or breast?
Wing.
Oh, wing. How did I forget the wing?
Wing.
Wow. I'm gonna get demerits for that one.
Yeah.
Twitter or Insta?
Instagram.
You've got two accounts. You've got your own and then you got a food one?
I have four.
I have four.
Jesus. Questlove Supreme, my iHeartRadio podcast, Questlove's Food, and then Questlove. And I think I'm still in the roots, so okay. that counts, right?
Food for thought or food for pleasure?
Food for pleasure, but don't overdo it like I did.
Triangle slice or square slice?
Man. Okay. I live in Chinatown, which is five blocks away from...
Scars, yeah.
Damn, you're good.
Well, we got a lot of... There's a lot of love for Scars at BA.
Do you feel it?
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm there too often. Yeah, but they do a really good square pie. I mean, they mostly have the round pies, but the square pies are surprisingly good there.
Okay, so what is your... For you, because there's two spots I like in New York. There's a place on Fulton called Little Italy.
Okay.
Their crust is buttery and crispy, which I love. And then on 7th Avenue, right where it's kind of a triangle that's near the firehouse, where all those dedications for 9/11 firefighters were, there's a pizza spot right on the corner.
There's Bleecker Street Pizza right by.
But it's
Barrow
like right in that triangle.
And then there's also Joe's, which is on.
I think this might be.
This one is. Yeah.
It's on 7th Avenue, and right when you make that little left that would
onto
lead
Greenwich
you.
Greenwich Avenue?
It's like the Greenwich Avenue turn.
Yeah.
There's a pizza spot there. And I only know them because they're always like, the guy from Kimmel. Like, no.
No, Kimmel.
But it's to the point now, it's like 5 years in. I'm like, yeah, it's me. Those are the spots. But, you know, I did the line standing one in Dumbo. Grimaldi's?
Oh, Grimaldi's. I still
What do you feel about the, what do you feel about the family's?
Grimaldi's and Patsy's and all that. I just don't care. I mean, I love them. I love the history of them. At our age, Amir, if I may, I just don't have time to wait in line.
So for you, what is it?
I mean, I do love Scars. I like a good sausage and onion is my preferred topping if I'm going all in.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been making at home a lot. We do a lot of, I buy dough at Eataly over here. They have good fresh dough.
I know that.
You heat up a skillet really hot, put the dough in the skillet, cover it with cheese and sauce, put it back in the ovens. You get cast iron skillet pizza. Gets super crispy on the bottom, puffs up, gets all charred. I'm gonna show you a photo on my phone. You're gonna be like, "Damn!"
For real.
Emma's like telling us to keep it moving. All right, next question: John or Paul?
George.
Oh, come on!
No, I'm a Paul guy.
Okay. He could write a hit. Questlove or Amir?
Are we friends?
Well, that's what I don't know. I don't know what to call you.
We're friends now,
okay,
right?
Okay, we're friends.
Amir.
Okay, there you go. That's the answer. All right, last question. We ask this to all our guests: butter or olive oil?
Coconut oil.
Oh God, Damn.
I'm sorry.
But I like that. We've never gotten that one before.
I do everything with coconut oil.
Amir Questlove Thompson, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
The Bon Appetit Foodcast is produced and edited by Emma Wertzman, with additional programming help from Carrie Polis and Elise Inamine. Our theme music is by Nathaniel Wertzman. We have new episodes every Wednesday, and if you want to reach out to us about this episode or any other episode, email us at bonappetitfoodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.